It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 482 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I get to welcome back two of my favorite guests, Frank Martin and Sean McCardle. Frank has a Kickstarter going on right now for The Last Homicide, number one of a two-part crime noir detective story. We talk about his various writings and how he's able to write in many different genres and do it very well. Of course, I'm a big crime drama fan, so this is something I enjoy talking about. So I really have a good time talking with Frank. Be sure to support his Kickstarter as soon as you listen to this episode. Then it's the return of Sean McCardle from The Fuhrer and the Tramp. It's a terrific book, and it's collected now into one edition from Sourcepoint Press. It's an escapade that features Hitler versus Charlie Chaplin, and it's a great adventure with lots and lots of historical elements thrown in. Just a wonderful story that will keep you engaged just like it did me for a long time, and there might be more in our future, which Sean talks a little bit about, so I'm sure you can enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's always great fun to talk with Frank Martin, a great comic creator of many things, including the Polar Paradox. Oh, the Macabre, Motel Macabre, have I got that backwards? I think it's
Macabre Motel.
Macabre Motel, okay. And now, The Last Homicide. So, Frank, it's always good to talk with you. You've always got some really interesting things going on, and you've got a Kickstarter. People get mad at me because I don't say that right away. You've got a Kickstarter going on for The Last Homicide. And as we were looking at before we started to record, you're in a good spot. You're not there yet, but you're within striking distance. So if people have not been backed you yet, be sure to get on there and back it right when you get done listening to this episode. So how you doing, Frank?
I'm doing good. Wayne, you're my Kickstarter good luck charm. I can't do one without you.
Okay. Well, this one, as I was telling you before we started recording, is one of my favorite subjects. I really and truly love crime drama and mysteries and detective stories, and this one is a detective story. Yeah, so
it's a straight, hard-boiled kind of crime mafia detective story. I don't kind of pair it with sci-fi, no fantasy, no kind of nothing else going on, just true to the genre. Go right to the core.
See, that's good, though, because as a writer, you're able to do these different things, science fiction, horror, and now, of course, crime drama, which is a terrific one. And boy, there's plenty of stations on my cable that would love nothing better than to have more crime drama. So this is a good place to go, I think. You're in the right genre this time. Of course, you're in the right genre all the time because you always do a good job with that. So why don't we talk about The Last Homicide? Well, why don't you describe what the story is about to start?
All right. So the premise of The Last Homicide is you have these two detectives. One is aging. He's kind of retiring. And the other is his young partner, his young kind of snarky partner. And it's their last homicide together because the older detective is retiring. That's where the title comes from. And on their last homicide case together, it's the murder of a mob boss's son, his adult son. And in this city that's kind of crime-ridden and built on corruption, you have rival gang bosses, mob bosses. And they've always been on the verge of all-out war. And everybody's afraid that with the death of one of their sons, it's going to tip the scales into a gang war. So with their last homicide case together, they have to figure out who the killer is to try to prevent this gang war from happening.
Mm-hmm. There's a description. You made the first issue available to me, which I got a chance to read. I really enjoyed, of course. Like I said, crime drama is one of my very favorite genres, you know, science fiction, all these things. I really like it. There was a description at the end of the book that I really liked, and it talked about, well, I got to read the sentence. You talk about a detective story, and then you go down a little farther and say, it's about characters, their relationships, and the dead body that stands between them.
Yeah, that's the afterword that I wrote for the book.
Yeah, I like that sentence. That's a good one.
I really like that. I mean, yeah, I was talking in that afterword. I was basically talking about why this genre was chosen for the golden age of Hollywood. You know, they didn't have big sets or like Westerns that they could go out to Utah or Arizona and film. And they didn't have crazy CGI that they could rely on. So they chose this because it's as drama filled suspense as you can get. You know, it's just pure characterization, pure relationships of those characters, and you throw in a bit of mystery with the dead body, and you got yourself a timeless story that you could tell in a million different ways.
Yeah, it's just amazing to me. I couldn't help but think about this. About there was a time when I wasn't employed, and I actually had free time, which I don't anymore. But I watched Investigation Discovery, I think is the name of the channel. And the way that they do this is they end the episode and cut right into the next one. And I think Forensic Files does that as well. And if you're not careful, you'll be watching these shows for days. And that's what I ended up doing. Although I have to say, I got depressed after a while because I kept watching all these people killing each other hour after hour after hour. And I kind of finally got to the place that I got to turn this off.
That's why they're so big on Netflix and streaming sites, all these true crime dramas, because they go right into the next one, and it becomes – there's such encapsulating stories. I mean, it's sad that they're real stories, and they become – kind of gut-wrenching and heartbreaking. But human beings have a fascination with crime, man. It's kind of morbid, but we live in a society that's sort of when things are going good, everything is normal, everything is nice. But when things don't go normal, it kind of enthralls us, and we don't want to be a part of it, but we still have to watch it unfold.
Yeah, it's just something. Well, why don't you talk a little bit about who the two main characters are? You said one of them is getting ready to retire. This is the last one. The other one's a younger one. Who are these people? A little bit more about them.
So Detective Wilmer is the older detective, and he's been in this city as a homicide detective a long time, and he's very frustrated with the system. And he realizes because the politicians are so corrupt, the mob owns everything, that he has a line that – oh, no, the police chief has the line where he says, we don't fight crime, we manage it. You know, that's kind of what they do, is that they're just going through the motions. Nothing they do ever changes anything. And he's got one foot out the door, and he's just like, let's just solve this case. Let's try to prevent this mob war, and I'm going to move on, because it's just going to be a stopgap measure till the next time something like this happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So which will be something. I'm kind of interested. This is part one of two.
Yes.
You know, why not do the whole story? Why did you do the first part?
I wanted – it was just basically format reasons. I wanted to keep it shorter. The first part is essentially a meet and greet for the characters and the situation, and we figure out what's going on, and we set the stage for the drama. And part two is when the mystery is really going to start to unfold, and we figure out what's going on, why is it going on, and how it concludes.
Mm-hmm. Now – something interesting that you did. I'm always interested in strong female characters. And you have, let's just say that in the old stories, you would not see a female crime boss. But yeah. You did that this one. And I thought that was very creative and something interesting. Talk about going that route with a crime boss. Because, you know, of all the shows I've ever watched, I think there was only one I saw on USA Network, I think, that had a woman that was in charge. So talk about going that route, because that's really that's someplace we haven't been. So I like that.
Well, there's two kind of reasons or explanations for that. One was a practical reason, is in that there's no other female characters in the story, at least not that I could think of off the top of my head. So I wanted to diversify it a little bit. That was a little bit of a practical reason. But there's a storytelling reason for it too, in that she is the mother of the the son that dies at the beginning of the story. So you're coming at this character from two different angles. She's both a ruthless gangster mob boss who has no problem mouthing off to these cops that come to her and try to question her. And she's also a grieving mother. And she has that mother's love for her son. So she's got these two contradictory emotion or character traits that are inside of her. And she reconciles them perfectly. You know, she's perfectly content and comfortable both grieving for her son and being this vengeful mob boss that wants to take it out on her rival. So I find her to be one of my favorite characters in the story.
Yeah, she's really interesting. Now, I don't think you ever identify which city this is.
I don't, and I did that on purpose.
Okay. So that's – it could be in our city. Is that the idea?
A little bit. Not. I wouldn't say so much like that. I tend to stick away from any sort of specific location factors in a lot of my stories. And I do that too with pop culture or specific places. Like my characters rarely go to eat at like a McDonald's, you know, something that's like a name that people recognize. And I do that a little bit to keep stories timeless in a way. And I like crime stories, especially like comic book crime or comic related crime, if we see it in movies, of fictional cities that are completely corrupt, you know, where it's just this city that's detached from like a real world city where it's just totally grimy and it's something completely separate from our reality. Even though this is a complete grounded story in reality, there's no fantasy involved. There's something about having a little pocket city that doesn't exist in our world that allows me leeway as far as storytelling and ways to play with it. And we do that a lot with the art too, because there's a lot of different influences going on here. We have a whole bunch of establishing shots that really play around with that cinematic feel. And there's architecture that resembles New York and Chicago and Miami. So it's, you never really get your bearings. It's kind of all over the place.
That's cool. Now the artist is Pietro Vaughn, I think is. I'm sure I butchered that name terrible.
No, Pietro Vaughn is the, he does the line art. And Eugene Bettevue does the colors, and I think they do a phenomenal job working together at setting the mood and the tone and the atmosphere of the story.
Now, as far as the artists being involved in like the setting of the characters, did those people have to do with the look of the characters? I mean, did you come to them and say, "I want them to look like this"? Are they based on real people or actors? Are they creations of the artist? How did that happen?
No, they're complete. That's one of my, I would say, my weaknesses is that I'm not very good at character descriptions or character creation as far as look and feel and stuff like that. I mean, I give general kind of descriptors, but for the most part, they are completely creations of Pietro and how he envisions them.
Okay, even the let's just say the body, shall we say?
Yes. There you go.
I have to say, I really like the way that he portrayed that. It reminded me very much of the movie Stand By Me. I you know, the first time you see a dead body, it's something you never forget. Mm-hmm. And when I saw the look, the way that they had portrayed it on there, it reminded me very much of that. And I had that very kind of shaken feeling when I was looking at it, because he really does an amazing job on the expression of the way that the body looks.
Yeah, because, you know, this is, even though it's a crime story, it's not like a Pulp Fiction where it's overtly violent, you know. We're dealing with crazy mob bosses and a city of corruption and a dead body, but there's very little violence involved, especially in this part one of the story. So that initial scene of that corpse is a really stark contrast to the way the rest of the story plays out.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about the coloring, but I don't know if I want to spoil something.
Tread lightly.
Okay. There's one of the crime bosses. There's this particular color that's used for this crime boss. The way that we talked about the woman looks, you know, normal, but the other guy, let's just say that there's a color that's used for him when he's on the screen, when he's on there talking to people and stuff like that. It's not a flesh tone.
No, I think I know what you're talking about. That's just more of a mood choice, and I think it okay. And I think it works. Mm-hmm. This is a very kind of Art Deco that kind of feel for the story, where he plays around a lot with shading and tints, and it really I think it really grounds the story in that pulp feel, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when I looked at it, I got that feeling that this guy is in the shadows. And that's why he's the color that he is. They didn't want to use black, because then we couldn't really see his expressions and stuff like that. So they used a different color in order to portray that. So I thought that was one of the things that I really liked about it. I thought it was and I have to say too that the expressions are really cool on the various characters. I always say that there's two things that I judge a comic by the action sequences and the facial expressions. And I thought they did a really good job. There are several times. What's funny is even when they use shadows, our imagination can kind of fill in. There's a place where the two detectives are somewhere and they hear a noise. Mm-hmm. And the use of shadow is so good. My head actually filled in all the facial expressions. That was just a really well done way to do that. I really like that. That this book is really I could this really could be on Investigation Discovery or somewhere else, one of the many crime drama channels that are out there. I think it'd be really excellent, because I really like that about that.
Yeah, we had to be tricky, because this type of story, you know, I don't have a whole lot of, unlike Polar Paradox, which is completely adventure and action driven, and that is used to carry the reader around. We have to rely on other tips and kind of tools, because this is not an action driven story. It's a hard boiled kind of character drama driven story. So we have to use stuff like that with the art in order to pull the reader in, keep the reader engaged, and really make them keep turning the page.
Yeah, drama as opposed to action, kind of what you do. So you get one or two events that propel the story, but the rest of it is drama, which is typical for those kinds of things. And you have to unfold the story. Now, see, there's an interesting thing about mysteries and detective stories and stuff. I was listening to somebody who writes them one time, and they said something, and I want to see if this is what you did. He said to me that when you write a mystery story or even a detective story like this one, you start out with the ending and then you write backwards. You know where you're going, and then you go backwards knowing that's where you're heading. Did you do that this time, or how did you approach it?
Yes.
Okay.
So, I mean, well, first off, I started with a premise, and that basic premise was our relationship between the detectives and the city that they're in. And obviously the mystery is really driven around who the killer is, you know, because that's the goal. That's what they're trying to figure out. So yeah, it's impossible to write the story without having that answer. So while yes, I did start with the premise, and that's how I wanted to be the launch pad for the story. I then went to the end, and then I filled in the middle. So yes, the ending is completely important, because it's all got to make sense. It's all got to tie in. You can't just pull a rabbit out of your hat at the end of the story and just be like, oh, it's this the killer was this random guy that's walking down the street that we've never met before. You know, that's not going to be a satisfying end.
No.
So you really have to construct it like an architect. And, you know,
well, that's every good mystery writer always tells me that's the way that it goes. It's like driving a car is the way that I put it together. You get in a car and you drive somewhere, you know, you're going someplace. You know, it's not like you're just, some people, you know, we used to go for a drive and we would just sort of wander around in the car and see stuff. With a mystery, you have to get somewhere. And if you don't know where you're going, it's hard to get there.
It's also hard to make it a worthwhile experience, you know, because if you know where you're going, you know what's going to happen at the end. You can pepper in clues make the experience more worthwhile. If you just come up with the ending as you go, the reader's going to look back in the story and be like, huh? Well, where did this come out? It just came out of left field. But if you drop little hints, little tidbits that tie it all together, it's gonna stay with them well after the last page, which is what I hope to accomplish.
I used to watch Perry Mason movies. The original show, I think, was better. But when I got to the movies, what the movies would do was we would watch good – hour and 45 minutes having no idea what was going on. And suddenly this thing would be revealed and now we know what's happening. And I used to sit there and I would go, why did I watch this whole 2 hours? I could have just turned on the last 15 minutes because I just couldn't bear. I stopped watching them after a while because I just couldn't, it just didn't make sense to me to have this suddenly at the last second, something show up and then everything makes sense. You know, why bother? So I think you're doing it the right way.
Well, thank you. Well, it's only part one. Don't hold off your applause until the second part.
See, I'd love to spoil a bunch of stuff because you have a great cliffhanger. Maybe that's the way to do it. At the end of the first issue, something happens and something is revealed, shall we say.
And that case.
Huh?
You could say a detail of the case is revealed.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. Something is that we don't know becomes available. But the good news is it's not near the end. It's halfway through. And that's a great way to tell the story because now I'm kind of fascinated by the reveal, and I'm not going to spoil it in any way. But it was a twist that I wasn't expecting, so I kind of liked that.
Well, I'm glad to surprise you.
Yeah, I want so badly to spoil that, but I won't. It makes the second half of it very interesting to me because it's a pivot. You know, it's what I call a story pivot. You're going somewhere and suddenly you move a different direction. We come to find out that things aren't what they appear to be. That's the only way I can say it without spoiling anything. Cause I want people to read it and enjoy it like I did. And then be able to really get a good experience, a good time reading it like I enjoyed.
Yeah. I mean, these stories are – I like the – have you ever seen the movie Adaptation with Nicolas Cage? Is Nicolas Cage?
I think so. I forget. It's been a while.
Adaptation.
It's been some time. But, the thing – I love a good story that keeps me engaged. And
Nicolas Cage. It's a crazy Charlie movie about Charlie Kaufman, the writer. And he has this line in the movie about writing that if you wow the audience in the end, that's all that matters, you know? So mysteries are this weird thing where you can have this great story 90% of the way. And if you don't wow them in the end, it's all for naught. So, and the flip side is true. If you could have 90% of a bad story, if somehow they stuck around that wrong and somehow you have a crazy ending that ties it all together, that makes them go, wow, I guess it's all worthwhile. But so, yeah, I feel I wouldn't say I'm nervous, but I'm kind of excited to see how people, the general response from part one has been positive. So I'm interested to see if the response from part two, which has the ending that it's all going to hang on, whether or not that's going to be the big payoff that everyone's hoping it will be. And I can consider the story a success.
Well, great. Now, the one thing I didn't mention, I really should, is when this concludes, this is going to conclude on Tuesday, April 27th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
That's the campaign. The conclusion of the story.
Yeah. Oh, no. I'm talking about that. When I talk about Kickstarters, people always say, you never give the details. Well, I want to make sure I get the details in there. But, of course, that leads to a good question. It's not – you haven't reached your goal yet. It's not a success yet, but I'm sure it will be. Do you have any idea when part two is going to – you're probably going to kickstart that one too, I would imagine. Do you know when that's going to rise up?
Right now, off the top of my head, I'm hoping for January.
Okay.
So and I got a bunch of other stuff in between now and then. My next campaign will be probably in June for Polar Paradox Part 2. So that's a couple months between Part 1 and Part 2 for that book. This one's going to be a little bit longer. And the reason for that is the script is all done, but we haven't started the art for it. And the reason for that is because one of our reward tiers is to be drawn in as a main character in Part 2. So we're offering that as a reward. So if nobody picks it up, no worry, we'll start the art. But if somebody does get it, we want to make sure to include them. So we want to hold off until
then. That's one of my very favorite things in a Kickstarter, is to do that. Now, I guess we should talk about that. How much does it cost to get written into put into the story?
Off the top of my head, I'm not sure. I think it's $425. That's what the level is.
Yeah, there you are. Become a character in TLH Part 2, $425. So that's cool. I've already signed up for this, by the way. And I signed up for the Last Homicide theme song.
Oh, both. Yes, thank you for that, Wayne.
I like that. I got the you get the theme song, you get the standard cover, and you get the digital deluxe in that one. So I decided I wanted to get that one because I always am interested in music, especially those associated with comics. Every time I see a theme song or a soundtrack or something involved, I'll always go to that level.
Yeah,
try to get that.
A buddy of mine, Lane Thomas, I've commissioned in my past couple campaigns to do music, to do themes, starting with the Macabre Motel. And he's done a phenomenal job with each one. They've all been different genres, and he's really tailored the style and the theme to what the book is. And so I'm super excited to be offering them. And it just kind of makes it for a well-rounded experience, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the other levels, which is $25, you get a black and white noir edition.
Yes.
That's the cover?
That's the standard version of the cover, except it's with no colors and no dress. So there's no logo, there's no credits, there's no colors. It's not grayscale. It's just kind of stark black and white. And I think it looks great. And that's something we're only going to be offering through Kickstarter. I'm not going to have it through my store or conventions or anything like that. So I've had a bunch of people grab that.
Now, there's a funny level that I have to ask about.
I know what that is too.
Blood $75 or more, you get the private Drabble lesson.
Yes. Nobody's taking me up on it yet.
Okay. Why don't you describe what that is?
So that I like to create reward tiers at different levels. So I always have problems with that $75 level. I never quite know what to put there. And I'm experimenting with different things. And I'm kind of thinking about what's a good marketable skill that I could put in there. And what a drabble is it's a short story of exactly 100 words, not 99, not 101, exactly 100. And I've written a lot of these and I'm pretty good at them. So I figure if anyone is interested in writing, if anyone's interested in learning more about how to craft these kind of stories, which are more along the lines of puzzles than actual stories, then I was offering a private kind of like Zoom lesson. 45 minutes. I give you the tips and tricks. I'll take you through the process and how I personally do it. And we'll write some drabbles and we'll come up with some for your own.
Okay. The way it was written, I thought it was private drabble, like a person, private drabble in the military or something, private drabble.
That's very funny.
I didn't realize what it was, but then you've also got like a short detective story commission.
Yes.
That you will write us a thousand word short detective story featuring you as the main character or any story of your choosing.
Well, I always
you got one.
Yeah, I always offer this tier every campaign I do. And I mainly do it out of jealousy because artists can always offer commissions and can do drawings and writers never get the chance to do that. So I always offer that. And I get one or two people that pick me up on it every campaign. And I always go with the theme of what the story is. You know, for Macabre Motel, I said I'll write you going to the motel for a stay. And for this, I said you can do a mystery, but really it could be any story, anything you want to do. And I love doing it. I love interacting with backers who kind of give me their ideas or what they want to see. And I love crafting stories that way. So I feel kind of honored and blessed that I get to do that every campaign. I always get one person that takes it.
Okay.
At least.
Is it the same person?
No, actually, no, I've never had repeat repeat people pick it up. So that's kind of cool.
Oh, very cool. Because somebody might have a collection of your short stories somewhere. And not yet. If they're published Frank Martin's short stories and you don't get anything of it, I wouldn't be very happy.
That would be, I know it, I would be honored.
Oh, would you? Okay.
I'm a simple guy, Wayne.
Okay. Because it's really, really cool. And then I've got to talk about, of course, somebody that I've interviewed on this podcast is Luke Cooper. Mm-hmm. And he does a Hollow Girl.
Yes. Luke does one of our variants for this book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he does. Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. I think that's at the $20 level. You can grab one of Luke's variants. And I always try to hit up Luke for a variant cover when I'm in a genre that I think he'll dig. Because he did a cover for Macabre Motel because he's into kind of weird stuff. I didn't ask him to do Polar Paradox because it was sci-fi adventure. I don't think that's really his wheelhouse. But he's a noir guy. I think he loves this kind of genre. So I kind of tapped him for it, and I think he did a great job.
Great. Because there's it's fun to see different people do different kinds of stories. See, I'm always impressed that you can do these different storytellings. You know, not everybody can do that. Some people are good at Westerns, and that's all they can really write. And if they try something else, it doesn't work. But the fact that you can do all these different stories and different kinds of genres, I always think that's a great sign of a great writer. So, and this one, it the tone is completely different from the other stuff of yours that I've read, and it's perfect for the genre. So I think if you can get into that, and make that kind of thing happen, I think that's wonderful. I think you did a great job. I mean, Polar Paradox had a very strong sci-fi feel to it. The motel one just got me. Like I said, I felt like I've been to that motel someplace. So with this one here, it had very much reminded me of the mystery dramas that I enjoy on the television. So I thought that was great. That the fact that you can step into that genre and make it happen and make it be appropriate for that genre, I think is really that's a great skill that you have for that.
Thank you. That just comes from a childhood consuming stories and movies and video games and just knowing what works and what doesn't work. And I mean, I like to think that anybody can really write anything if they're exposed to it enough. You know, it's just a matter of, not coming at something completely out of the blue and just having some relationship to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, someday you're going to have to cross over all your books. You're going to have Modern Testament, cross over with Motel, and go to
Macabre,
Polar Paradise.
Myths of the paradoxical homicide.
Yeah, you'll have to have one character jump from each story to another and have it all tie together and make sense. That would be something.
Don't challenge me, Wayne. I don't like anytime somebody tells me I gotta do something, I try to figure it out.
Well, Modern Testament was a great one. That's how I originally came into your writing, was through that, which I really liked. And then you did a crossover with somebody else, and that was kind of fun. And then you start doing these other stories, which I really enjoyed them all. I always feel like this should be on television. This is another one. This one ought to be on Investigation Discovery, although they tend not to do detective stories. They tend to do other stuff. It might have to be – there's other ones on there. Gosh, there's hundreds of them. But, you know, just any one of them wants it, I think that would be a great story on there.
I was concerned about this campaign, especially when I sent it out to people to review and to give a read before interviews, because it's a little bit of a throwback to the old school kind of hard boiled, slow burn mysteries. You know, we see stuff on TV nowadays that's all jam packed and filled with action and sci-fi and all that craziness. And this is not one of those stories. So I didn't know how it was going to resonate with today's audiences and readers. But people like yourselves say that they enjoy it. They enjoy the characters. They enjoy the scenes and the scenarios and the dialogue. So it's been a big relief.
Well, that's good, because I have to be honest with you, I like different kinds of storytelling. You know, I like a good mystery story where I'm sitting there trying to figure out who did it. And I like science fiction because, you know, it's a totally different kind of tale for me. I thought Modern Testament was a really interesting approach to, like, I don't know, paranormal or godlike characters and things like that. So all these things have had very different perspectives on it. And I like that. I don't want to just read the same old things. I much as I love my Long John stories, I like the people who can write the stories and do something a little different with it and just even take them in a slightly different direction. So, which of course makes me want to ask you, and of course I hate to do it because maybe you'll feel like you have to. What about a superhero story?
Oh, I got them coming, Wayne. Don't worry about me. I got plenty of superhero stuff on the horizon. You know,
okay. It's something to look forward to.
A lot of people kind of say, Frank, where do you have time to write all this stuff? Because you got so much stuff coming out, and they only see the stuff coming out. They don't see the years that were spent developing it and devising it and plotting them out and writing the script. So, all this stuff is kind of just converging at the same time. So I got tons of stuff that's coming out, and I remember one of the compliments you gave me on one of the stories, I can't remember what it was that I surprised you. And you said after so many years of reading so many stories, you want to be surprised. So to hear you say that you love mysteries and you want to know who done it, that's kind of a good compliment. I appreciate that.
Well, you've brought up an interesting subject to me, and some people don't know this. When a comic comes out, it looks like it just popped out. You know, people don't understand the process. And you and I have talked a little bit about that. But I'm just curious, when it comes particularly to The Last Homicide, how long have you been working on this?
4 years, maybe. This was a particularly long one.
Mm-hmm. The interesting.
The Pietro was working on several projects at the same time. So I always told him, no worries whenever you get to it. It was kind of a side project for all of us. So, this definitely took a while to get to. But now that I have part one locked in and ready to go, I'm going to make sure that the art for part two is done on a faster timetable.
Okay. Well, it's a good story. I really loved it. And I like the characters. I love – see, there are two stages of life that I'm particularly interested in. I'm interested in – when people switch from kid to adult, you know, that kind of story. But I'm also interested in end-of-life stories. You know, how do people wrap up their lives and stuff? So I'm interested particularly in the detective who is coming to the end. And, you know, we've all had jobs where we've had to leave. At least I have. I've had jobs where I've had to leave. And it's an interesting experience to walk out the door for the last time.
Yeah.
So I'm particularly interested in how this is going to end with him. So we'll see how that goes. I have some ideas, which I will not possibly say. Okay. But I'm going to be fascinated to see how that goes. Those two stages of life always fascinate me because, the thing that people do when they get towards the end is always – it's telling. And I'm going to be fascinated to see how he does that. And I won't ask for any spoilers or anything because I want to enjoy it. So it just looks like it's going to be great fun.
I mean, it's the reason why we titled the book The Last Homicide, because it's a big focus of the story, the fact that this is Detective Wilmer's last homicide case. And it's not just his last homicide case working it. It's his last time working with his partner. So Detective Gomez, who's his partner, is seeing this older gentleman who has just been he kind of sees his future in a way. You know, he hasn't reached that stage yet of cynicism where he's just run down from the centuries on the job. And there it's this dynamic between them as they work their last case together, and what that's gonna how they start the case and how they end the case is gonna be telling.
But you see, The Last Homicide might not be. So, you know, what happens if the guy decides, oh, no, I can't leave, and then decides to stay? Or let's just say something bad happens to the younger partner, something like that.
Well, it's a very interesting thing because the dynamic – a lot of people see a whole lot of different genre tropes in this book, and I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Seven, which with but the dynamic between our detectives is the same as the detectives in that movie. Morgan Freeman plays the aging detective on the verge of retirement, and Brad Pitt plays the spunky newcomer. So have you seen Seven?
Yeah, it's been a while, but yeah.
Yeah, so we see how that story starts with them, and we see how it ends. So it'll be cool to see how people react to how our story starts and ends with the same kind of dynamic.
It's going to be great fun. This is a great read, particularly within the genre. Like I said at the start, this is one of my very favorite genres. I love reading this stuff, and I think you really captured the spirit of it, as well as the storytelling aspects that make it such a great genre. So I think you've done a great job with this one, and I dying to see the second part now. Of course, I have to ask, when you call this the last homicide, is this the last homicide story, or might there be other stories coming?
Yeah, when you asked me that for the Macabre Motel and the Polar Paradox, my answer was kind of left ambiguous a little bit. It was left open-ended because the stories are open-ended a little bit. But with the last homicide, the way it ends is pretty definitive. So I don't see a follow-up or a sequel once these two parts are concluded.
Okay, but you might have other detective stories to tell.
Maybe, possibly. I, for the most part, my plate is full. So, if I do come back to the genre, I'm not sure what form it will be in.
Okay. Well, something like that. So we better treasure this while we can.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy it while we can do that. So once again, let's talk about the vital statistics. It's called The Last Homicide, number one of a two-part crime noir detective story. And as we're talking, you're about two-thirds of the way there. And hopefully by the time this posts, you have met your goal and are into stretch goals, which would be great. You over 100 backers. And that all-important thing, that this will be funded only if you reach your goal by Tuesday, April 27th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Don't wait that long. Now is the time to get on there and to support this good thing so Frank doesn't keep looking, you know, the old daily heart attack. We don't want that.
Refresh.
Yes. Oh, there's so many people I know who say they do that. They sit there hour after hour refreshing. And I say, you know, you're going to drive yourself crazy by doing that. Yeah. Sometimes I'm talking with people and I'll sit there and the number will start going up while I'm talking to them.
That would be good.
Yeah, that's always a good thing. I haven't seen it yet here, but, you know, I bet you it'll happen before too long. I bet if we do this a little long enough, I'll see something bump up there. It feels so funny because when we're talking about it, we always feel like we're going live and something happens. You feel like, well, maybe our discussion did that, but nope, that's not the case.
I try not to look. I find your happiness is directly linked to how much you check it, so.
Oh, really?
I try to just put my head down, do the things I need to do, and just not be a little barometer as to how much it is.
Yeah, that's probably the smartest thing. That's probably the wisest thing to do with that. Well, Frank, this is a great story. I'm dying to see the end. I can't wait to see it. It's perfect crime drama story, the kind just that I like. So I'm dying to see how this ends up. There's so many things that could happen with the title The Last Homicide. Good titles get your imagination going, and this is a great title because there are so many possibilities that I could think of. So I'm just dying to see it. So, Frank, just keep up the wonderful stuff, and I hope people get to read this. I think if you enjoy crime dramas and noir stories like I do, I think you're going to really enjoy this. I love the last page. It says, "In a city founded on corruption, the wrong murder has the potential to turn the streets into all-out war." That's a story I want to read. So that's really good. So, Frank, just keep it up. Much success. I'm sure this will get into the stretch goals, and that'll be fun to see what stretch goals you have in mind. And once again, I'm going to, just for those people who always want to know, you've got to get in there by Tuesday, April 27th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And make it happen so we can see all these good things. So, well, Frank, I'm sure this is going to be a success just like your other ones have been, and we'll get to see more of your writing and other genres. I'm tempted to ask you what other stuff you got coming, but you probably can't tell us at this point.
I mean, I can tell a little bit.
Okay.
I have three more campaigns this year. One will be the second part of Polar Paradox.
Okay.
That's going to be my next one. After that is a book called Pipe Creepers, which is kind of it's a horror book, but it's not like super horror. It's kind of more just like spooky fun a little bit. It's the premise. I'll give you a little teaser. I would say the way I would kind of pitch it is Super Mario Brothers versus Cthulhu.
Okay. So, that's different. I haven't seen that before. That's a good thing about your writing. I really do enjoy where you go places where I haven't been.
It's a horror book, but it's a fun horror book.
Okay.
It's not meant to be super scary. More just like eerie and spooky and fun.
Ooh, that'll be good. That'll be fun because when you measure the blood in quarts, I get a little nauseated. So I always like something that's not quite like that. So that sounds like more up my alley.
Well, and then my last campaign of the year will be for a book called The Truce, which I'm really looking forward to. It's a one shot, and that will be – it's kind of like a post-apocalyptic kind of war story. It's a little bit of a thriller. It's got a lot of action to it. I guess you would call it a little bit sci-fi. It's a little bit of everything. It's hard to describe, but it's a book that I'm really looking forward to because I really enjoyed putting this thing together.
Oh, great! Well, lots to look forward to. So, but in order to get there, we got to make sure this one is a good success. So, get out there and support The Last Homicide. And Frank, look forward to talking with you when the next one comes around. So, just keep up the great stuff. That's all I can say.
I appreciate it, Wayne. Thank you so much.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast, so you can keep reading your comics.
It's a pleasure to welcome back to the podcast Sean McArdle from The Fuhrer and the Tramp, who's got some really big news for us, among other good things. How you doing, Sean?
Oh, excellent. Thanks for having me on, Wayne.
It's good to talk with you. So what's the good stuff that you want to let everybody know?
Well, we're finally releasing the trade paperback, collecting all five issues of The Fuhrer and the Tramp into one trade paperback with a bunch of new material. It's full color, and we've got some annotations in the back, quite a few annotations because I like those sort of things myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some new jokes and a lot of new art from Dexter.
Very good. Very good. Because you and I talked, I think it was a little over a year ago, and I think you were two thirds of the way through this project at that point. And so it's great to hear that you've gotten this is complete and it's going to be available. Do you know when is this going to be available?
It's in this month's previews. So you can go to your comic store and grab a couple at Diamond, and it's by Source Point Press. So toward the back in the S's part of the comics catalog, and let me make sure that I'm saying this right. I'm pretty sure it's April 21, 1923. Let me look. That's the order code.
Oh, okay.
Let me check that. Make sure. I should know that.
Oh, man. Kind of funny.
I think I could find it whenever I needed it, but no, I was right. It is April 21, 1923.
Okay, very good. Something to get and make sure you get it because we talked about this a while back, and I really enjoyed the story. It's a historical story. It's set back in the past, and it's got some very well-known people involved. Why don't you talk about what the basic storyline is? Of course, it's called The Fuhrer and the Tramp. We have a basic idea, the two of the people.
Yeah, yeah. It's about Hitler and Charlie Chaplin. And Hitler gets wind of Chaplin going to make the great dictator and make a movie that's mocking Hitler. And he doesn't like that very much. So he tries to sabotage the set, send his Nazi goons out there to sabotage the set, blow it up, and maybe even assassinate Chaplin. And Chaplin fights back and is determined to make his movie, teams up with a couple of FDR's secret agents, Errol Flynn and Hedy Lamarr. And they help him fight off Nazis, punch a bunch of Nazis in the face. And, you know, maybe even Charlie will get to do what he wants, which is reclaim his mustache and punch it off Hitler's face.
Yeah, it's a great action adventure kind of story as I remember it. And I think I got to see the fifth part was in black and white at that point when we were talking. So
that was a while ago.
Yeah, so that was a good thing about that. So why don't we cover a little bit of ground we probably did before, just in case people haven't heard it. Why do this story about, because comics today are so many superheroes and other things like that. Why do a historical drama that's based in the past, that's kind of a place that comics are, they fear to tread these days, but you did a good job with it, but why go there?
Oh yeah, and I never even thought about it like that. It was just something that that turned me on. Something that I thought like, okay, this idea has some promise. You know, there's something here. I was wanting to work with my buddy John Judy. He was the co-writer of *Fear and the Tramp*, and I wanted to collaborate with him on something. So I've been pitching him a couple ideas, and he really didn't gravitate to any of those. But both of us have like a love of like classic Hollywood, and also John is a very big fan of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He even has like a bust of FDR in his living room, and he reads like every autobiography on him. He has an entire like his section on FDR is probably as big as my entire library.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's that. But he's also a big fan of Chaplin and silent Hollywood and also the, 1940s Hollywood. So it was just something that I knew that he was really into, I was into, and then we could have something that we could jam on together. And I thought this style would work well with Dexter Wee, who we've collaborated with several times before, and I love working with Dexter. So if I can get a project I feel is in Dexter's wheelhouse, he's going to be my go-to. It was like whenever I pitched it, My problem is I have a very difficult time coming up with an elevator pitch. Like, it takes me generally like half an hour to pitch something, and then we get to the actual like the hook. Mm-hmm. Half an hour in. Mm-hmm. This one I was able to pitch in like a sentence to him. Charlie Chaplin fights Hitler while making the Great Dictator. Boom. And he can kind of envision what this whole thing's going to be like. It's going to be slapsticky, but yet adventure and action and, making a movie in golden age Hollywood and Nazis attacking and, all that fun stuff. So
it's a great story. I really enjoyed, what I read of it, and just a fascinating, especially if you know a little bit about the people in that time, and there are other people that they come across in this process. So it's a great adventure story, lots of good things. And, people always ask who's the best villain and stuff. Some people say Darkseid and some people say Dr. Doom. And I always say, well, I think the Fuhrer was probably the best villain.
Yeah, it's that was one of the things too, is like I did a ton of research. So like I conceived of this. This was like I was just I was looking at 40 in the eyes. I was just about ready to turn 40. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things too. I wanted to complete something or make something, and I was having my little midlife crisis there and stuff. Mm-hmm. Wanting to make something that mattered to me. Mm-hmm. And so it's like 2015 or so. And so Dexter was already working on another project. So we had about a year that we had to wait for him to be done with his project and be able to work on ours. So I used that year just to do a lot of research. So I did everything. Like I read Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. I even read some of Mein Kampf.
Wow.
Whatever reason. And read anything I could find on Hitler, whatever. Read Charlie Chaplin's autobiography, Errol Flynn's, which is amazing. Hedy Lamarr's, which is also amazing. All three of them are actually really great.
Mm-hmm.
Then watched all their movies, or not all, but as many of their movies as I could find. I was constantly watching their movies, and all of that kind of seeped into this. It's fictional, but at the same time, I wanted there to be this veracity to it. This part that felt like it was kind of real, and that kind of by playing with like real stuff and then also fictionalizing it, you know, it created more of a, it gave like all the fictional parts a little bit more weight and made mm-hmm. them seem a little bit more real. Mm-hmm. And then also some of the factional things, you're like, really, what? Did that really happen? Did he do that? And it's like, yeah, he did that.
Wow. You know?
Errol mm-hmm. Flynn was actually that dude, you know, he did those things and stuff like Charlie Chaplin really did use iodine and paint it on his penis because he thought it would keep him from getting STDs. Those were just like real things that I had to put in the book because it was just weird and fascinating.
Well, it was a very different era.
It was. It totally was.
You know, what's interesting to me right now, it's interesting. They're advertising a Justice Society movie that's going to be set in World War II.
Oh, really? I didn't see that.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in.
Barry Allen of the Flash goes back in the past and runs into the Justice Society in World War II.
Oh, is that what that's going to be about? Completely redoing that Justice or the Society. Flash movie.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's still happening too. This is
another one.
Yeah, this is an animated one. The Flashpoint one is still going to happen. Okay. So, yours, by the way, ought to be, if it's not an animated movie, ought to be a real life movie. I could see this being a movie. This is just so many interesting things. If they could get actors that look like the characters, boy.
Yeah, I have my like little wish list, but yeah.
Oh. Because you know there's so many good action sequences and there's so much well, you know, like I said, Hitler just makes a wonderful bad guy, and the things that go on right now, punching Nazis is a big thing.
Like whenever I started writing this, it wasn't, I was just like, oh, like look at those olden days when there was Nazis, you know. Isn't that cute? And then now it's like, holy crap. It was weird while writing it because it became more and more pertinent. Mm. And I was like, it took on a new life that way too, as I'm creating it and writing it and seeing the way the world was kind of shifting toward totalitarianism and authoritarianism. And it's like, oh my God, we're like going right back to this. And then it just, what it did was, one of the big inspirations is Charlie Chaplin, his speech in The Great Dictator. I'm sure that most people have seen it posted on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
Maybe don't know what it's from. But so The Great Dictator was a movie where he portrayed Hitler. It was his first talking movie.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing of his first movie where he did not portray the tramp. Mm-hmm. And so you have the entire movie where he's, you know, lampooning Hitler, making fun of Hitler. This is right before World War II breaks out. And during during the filming of the Great Dictator, the Nazis invaded France,
mm-hmm.
barreled through France in the Blitzkrieg. And that's whenever World War II started, you know, that's whenever Britain declared war on Germany and, you know, everything starts happening then. You know, they were building toward World War II, but bam, it happens while he's making this movie. So it became more pertinent to him, too, while they're making it. And by the end of the movie, so there's all this, you know, tomfoolery and stuff and him just taking the piss out of Hitler and making fun of mm-hmm, him. And, you know, what I learned from this is that's how you deal with authoritarian regimes and how you deal with dictators is one of the best ways to defeat them is to mock them and ridicule them and show them for how ridiculous they actually are. Because one thing that I found by reading that and seeing our own flirtations with dictators and other dictators that I read about is usually it's the dictators come from a level of insecurity. They're not these Dr. Doom level supervillains. They're actually just extremely insecure because they're usually in a position of power that they should not be in. And so they're very much afraid of being taken out of that position. And that's what I found with Hitler was he was just lucky. The dude was not a super villain. He was not extremely intelligent. He was actually kind of dumb and he made a bunch of stupid mistakes. And a lot of his mistakes were because of his obvious insecurities about himself. And so they overcompensate for their insecurities. And that's what really makes them dangerous is that they're so insecure about their position and their power and their own intelligence and their own abilities that they overcompensate by just being cruel and by being, basically evil. And so I learned that from Chaplin, the best way to deal with that was just to laugh at him. And if you notice, I mean, that's kind of like how we defeated our dictators. You know, you laugh at them. You make a joke out of them. You show them, you point at them and show that the emperor is wearing no clothes. You know, that's how you defeat them. That's the thing that they're not immune to because that's their insecurity. That's the biggest insecurity. It's not their physical might. It's that people will realize how stupid they actually are. And so that's how I decided to portray Hitler was just make him really, really goofy. Just kind of lean into that producer's version of Hitler, you know, the one the Mel Brooks lampooning Hitler. Kind of lean into that a little bit more and just make him extremely insecure and very childish, prone to tantrums and pettiness. To me, I think that portraying it that way actually is kind of like a little bit closer to the Hitler I read about. But also portraying him that way too, not only diffuses him, but at the same time, it kind of underlines that danger of somebody being that we want our villains to be Machiavellian. We want them to be Hannibal Lecters and Lex Luthers and Dr. Dooms, but our bad guys are actually like Kim Jong-un, you know, they're dudes that are just super freaking insecure and stupid, really, really dumb. But, you know, they're so afraid that people are going to know that they're dumb, that they act out against anybody that's going to point that out or also that are going to challenge them. And that's what makes it super dangerous.
See, that's the thing that was the scariest to me. And I always puzzled over why Chaplin would want to make a movie. I mean, Hitler, he may not have been the sharpest tool in the drawer, but he was nasty.
Yeah.
When it came to that. And the fact that he was trying to make fun of him, you know, I'm sure he got threats in real life.
He did. He definitely did. And what's interesting is, and that's why I came to terms with, and the way that I kind of structured it, fictionally, but I think that there's an element of emotional truth to it is, you know, Chaplin always like was for the downtrodden. And there is a huge, I mean, in the movie, he plays two roles. He plays a Jewish barber and he also plays this dictator. You know, he's called Hinkle, but it's obviously Hitler. And, you know, he's dreaming of a perfect Aryan race and all kinds of stuff. And he's silly and goofy. Well, the barber ends up being mistaken for Hitler or for Hinkle, and he's taken up on stage and he gives a speech. And the interesting thing about it is, and that's what I was getting to, was that speech. So you get to that speech, and it's like at this time, 1940, Chaplin is probably the biggest, most well-known human to probably have ever existed on the planet. Because Chaplin was universal. The tramp was universal. You know, kind of point that out in the comic. It's like, you know, the tramp plays in Mozambique as well as, you know, Poughkeepsie. You know, the tramp played everywhere. You know, even today, the tramp is beloved in Iran, and there's big murals of Chaplin in Iran of the tramp. You know, that character is just universal. And so you have this new medium of film that at this time is only like 40 years old. And Chaplin has been a major component of it for 30 of those 40 years. You know, so he's one of the original guys in it. He's one of the only silent guys that is still relevant in 1940. You know, he makes Modern Times in 1936, and it's the biggest box office smash of 1936. And it's half silent, but you know, it's still a silent. It's the tramp is silent, and now he goes off and does something different. Does lampoons Hitler. And you know, this is in 1930, it comes out in 1940. So the German-American Bund is still a large thing. And there's a large Nazi party in the United States. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge portion of the United States that wants to back Germany and the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very, very dangerous time. And he just, at this point in the movie, if you just watch it and you just really watch it, you realize, okay, so he plays this Jewish barber. But at that point, he is not playing the barber, nor is he playing Hinkle. Mm-hmm. He's just being Chaplin. He is being Charlie Chaplin, using this megaphone, using this, his reach to the entire planet, and pleading with the entire planet, don't do this. And pleading with just normal, everyday people, don't listen to these people. Don't give yourself to tyrants. You are men. You're not machines. Don't be part of this machine. And it's such a beautiful, beautiful, eloquent speech that is still relevant today. Still so very relevant today. And I mark it as one of the greatest speeches in human history. Seriously, if you just look at all the great speeches, Chaplin's speech right there is so amazing, so gorgeous. And he is talking to the entire planet that had never been done before like that. It's so laudable and it's so ballsy. And so that's what I wanted to communicate, and that's what I wanted to capture in this book, was that, and lead up to that, and then just really, bam, lay down that speech, and just let Hitler choke on that speech. Yeah, you know, that was the plan.
Did he script that, or did he do that off the cuff?
He scripted it, okay. Because there's several different versions of it that you can find in his notes.
Oh, interesting. Yeah,
but it's scripted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's so impassioned, it doesn't seem like it, right?
Yeah, really. That's such a big deal. I mean, you want to make sure you get it right, I'm sure. Yeah. So that was definitely something he wanted to do. It's so interesting. You mentioned Modern Times, which is when I was a kid, my mom showed me. And, I still to this day laugh when I think about it. Yeah. And how appropriate that is for today.
Yeah,
you know, still today, all the, you know, he ends up, they bring out the ear of corn and they spin it around in front of the guy. He's got to eat it while he can't stop. He's got to do it while he's working.
Yeah.
All those things even when I was a kid, that was funny. And now it's hilarious because holy smoke, there's, you know, all these businesses. Well, do you have to really take a break? Can't you just keep going? Kind of stuff. And I Chaplin was way, way, way ahead of his time. Just way. So he's just, you know, there are visionaries that come around every once in a while, and he was certainly one of those. And, you know, even today, he's still a name that people recognize and certainly pay attention to. So just terrific.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely great. And, you know, I really came to appreciate Chaplin in a lot of different ways, too. He was a fantastic director as well. He gets known as the Tramp, but his innovations, I feel confident in saying this. And I know that it seems hyperbolic, but I put him up there with Orson Welles. I put him definitely up there with W.D. Griffith or D.W. Griffith. I really don't care much for Griffith. I think that some of the innovations that Chaplin was doing and the control that he had over – he was like Kubrick, where he did like multiple takes, you know, many, many multiple takes and just trying to get it right, get it perfect. Mm-hmm. He was also – he was a perfectionist that way, but he also – he scored his own movies. He was a camera operator on his own movies. He created a lot of the visual language that we still use today for movies. And, you know, even down to he was the only director that did this, that had his actors and actresses, they had to memorize their lines, even though it was silent.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually, like if you remember Singing in the Rain,
mm-hmm.
whenever they're recording, they're filming for the first time, and they're like using sound for the first time. And Gene Kelly, he's like, "Can I just say what I always say? I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you." Well, that's what they would do. That's really the joke there, is that's what silent actors would do. They would just say the same thing over and over again, or each actor had their own like little thing, and they would just repeat that. They wouldn't learn lines or anything, but Chaplin felt like actually saying the words would create a different performance. And of course he's right, mm-hmm. But he's the only guy doing that. And they're Chaplin movies, you know? It's like, mm-hmm. you know, he's not making Intolerance. He's not making, Sunrise. He's making The Kid. He's making Gold Rush. You know, he's making these funny movies that still have a lot of social commentary in them, and that are very, very progressive, even for that time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're making an interesting argument that maybe you should have called this book The Tramp and the Fuhrer.
You're right. But it was a playoff Lady and the Tramp.
But you're right. Because, although you have to say probably Hitler is still one of those subjects. You know, as much as Chaplin is beloved, Hitler is terrified. People are terrified of him. I mean, there are historical channels that run specials about Hitler endlessly, and I watch them sometimes. I think you and I talked about this the last time. There was a black book that they had developed, that Hitler had developed, of the people he was going to kill when he took control of England.
Yeah.
And when I first heard that, I was shocked. Yeah. You know, I couldn't believe it. You know, he was thinking that far ahead that he could actually, these are the people he wanted to get rid of. So I can understand why Chaplin was, we may not have known that at that time.
But
Chaplin understood, though, just how much of a terror that Hitler could be. And, you know, the more we found out, the more we realized Chaplin was absolutely right.
Well, you know, it really fit into, like, if you look at the totality of Chaplin's work, and I think it goes all the way back to, you know, him growing up as basically like the prototypical David Copperfield, you know, mm-hmm. basically his childhood is straight out of Dickens. You know, he's just like a little street urchin, you know, running the streets while, you know, his mom's a prostitute and he has syphilis, and you know, his older brother is the only one that's helping him out. And they're like, you know, getting in scraps with the neighborhood kids, and, you know, they're like conning people out and stuff. And that's how they're getting by. And so like, the like authoritarian powers and stuff as growing up in that society were always like looming over him. And so that's what he put forth in his movies. And that's what The Tramp is he's thumbing his nose at power. And so it does make sense that Chaplin would just go for it, just go for like, all right, this is a guy that is terrorizing Europe. He is the biggest bully on the planet. And that's who I'm going to go after. You know, that's who I'm going to mock. That's who I'm going to ridicule. And that's who I'm going to, thumb my nose at him. You know, I'm just going to, make fun of that guy. Plus, also, Hitler stole his mustache. He did. Seriously. Like, Hitler, like, shaved his mustache to look like Charlie Chaplin back at before the beer hole pooch and all that stuff in the early 20s, because Chaplin was so popular. It became a popular style, you know? It wasn't like he actually stole it. It was just like, because of Chaplin's mustache, it became a popular style in that part-time, in that piece. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Hitler, you know, he's like, you know, whenever you found your style as like a, you know, a sophomore in high school, and then you wore that until your 30s, you know, that was Hitler. He found that mustache and, you know, a sophomore in high school, and just boom, he's just staying on that mustache.
It's interesting because a lot of people associate Hitler with the mustache more these days.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it becomes difficult for me to market this because of that. Like, you know, I was thinking, you know, at cons, what would be cool is like I have a little chaplain kit, you know, like a little bowler and a little mustache they could put on. I was like, oh shit, I'm just giving these Proud Boys, you know, fucking Hitler mustaches.
Wow. Because the whole thing with Hitler is just, you know, I always have to mention, though, it reminds me very much, and everybody has seen this, there's a Bugs Bunny cartoon where he runs into Hitler.
Yeah.
And that he's doing the same thing that Chaplin was doing. He makes fun of Hitler quite much. You know, how stupid he is, you know, and Bugs Bunny, of course, outfoxes him on every turn.
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing with Chaplin. It's just so interesting because – you know, he wants to, you know, the thing that people really relate to are the ultimate little guys.
Yeah.
And how they do things. And I think that's, you know, that's clearly what Chaplin's trying to do. Even a big bully like Chaplin or like Hitler, Chaplin can certainly, you know, make that, can show just how, you know, how vulnerable and how unterrifying somebody like that can be. And I just think he did a great job with that. It's just amazing.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
And just your book, just I hope people get the chance to buy it. And do you know how much it's going to sell for?
It's $19.99.
Okay, so that's a very good price for that. If you have five issues in it?
Yeah, but the fifth issue is a double issue. So it's actually 192 pages of content.
Wow. All
full color. I colored it myself.
Wow.
Try to make it, you know, I went with, like, I wanted to look period specific with the coloring, but I didn't, you know, typically, like, whenever you do a comic and if you're trying to make it look period specific to the 40s, you do that kind of like newsprint, and like very heavy dot gain and halftone screens and stuff, like the old Batman and Superman and Action Comics of the day. Mm-hmm. Instead, what I looked at was like, illustrators of the day, like Maxwell Parrish and a lot of Parrish, and, you know, Montgomery Flagg and, you know, Norman Rockwell, of course, Rockwell, you know, but Wyeth, you know, I that's who I looked at for my color palettes.
So, well, it's very, very realistic. It's really very, very, it's perfect to look at too. It fits that era so smartly. You know, I worry today some because some people are trying to erase the past. And I always feel like the biggest mistake we make is to do that because, you know, the old business that we're doomed to repeat things if we don't pay attention to them.
Exactly.
And I think what your book is pointing out is that one of the things is that the past is something we ought to really pay attention to. And I hope that you know, hope that people really pay attention to this and get to understand exactly what, you know, what you're, a lot of the message you're trying to tell. Of course, you want to do an entertaining book. Of course, you want to tell a fun story, adventure and stuff. But there's also underlying themes to it that are really, I think, that people ought to be thinking about more today.
I think we're making this sound like it's, you know, like homework or it's like Schindler's List or
something. Yeah, which is not.
Like, no, it's actually like really funny. Mm-hmm. There's lots of jokes. Mm-hmm. I tried to make sure that there was at least a joke on every page.
and fun and adventure and daring do and buckle that swash.
Yeah.
I love that kind of story.
Yeah. So, I want it to be like a book that I wanted that I just don't see on the shelves. You know, I want something that look like, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark. I want it to look like Adventures of Robin Hood. I wanted it to be this, you know, big caper that was just fun, you know, more than anything else. It was fun.
Yeah. And I always like adventure.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get to see all these different characters all get involved. Chaplin, of course, is at the center of it. And Hitler is the person, the antagonist. But to see the other characters and get to know them a little bit, because a lot of us don't know who they were, you know, Hedy Lamarr and all the other characters. You give us a glimpse into who they are, who they were, and it's a lot of fun to learn those kinds of things. And I'm always interested in how things got to be the way they are and how these people certainly did things. So your book was a great fun read for me along those lines.
I'm glad to hear that.
You know, yes, a comic has got to have certain things that go on with it, but to have the fun aspects with also the learning aspects to have it. It's just one of those great books that I think that, gosh, it really ought to sell like hotcakes in my mind.
I hope so. I hope so. I'm really proud of it. And I would like to get more people to be aware of Errol Flynn and Hetty. They're fascinating people. Hetty was, she did a movie called Algiers, and then that was extremely successful. And that's what made Warner Brothers make Casablanca. And she was originally cast, or they were seeking to put her in Casablanca instead of Ingrid Bergman. So she could have had a whole different career and be known of very differently. She was like, I think that one of the things I found was she kind of sabotaged herself a lot, because she wanted to be known for, well, I wouldn't say sabotaged. It's a conflict between her and the Times and the studio system, which is, she was known as the most beautiful woman in the world at that time, but she wanted to be known as an inventor and as a, for intelligence. And she was. She has like hundreds of patents. And one of the things that she helped devise, like, was the basis for Wi-Fi. She was extremely intelligent. And I think that kind of, you know, she chose roles then where, you know, she was kind of always going against like what the studio wanted to push her into being, the, you know, the love interest in Casablanca or whatever. You know what I mean? She was trying to go for something different and never really caught the public eye, like, you know, some of the other actresses of the day. But she was extremely, that's the other thing, was she was extremely independent and did not take any crap from any of the studios. And and at that time, that kind of, you know, probably cost her from being as big as she probably should have been. And then Errol Flynn, you have on the other side, which is a guy that is very braggadocious and talks about like all of his exploits and stuff when he's on Australia and New Guinea. And he did that stuff. He really did that stuff. And he is a magnificent bastard. He is such a bastard. He is such an awful, awful human being in the most marvelous way. I don't know how to describe him. It's just, but I think whenever he came to Hollywood, you know, and he would regale everybody with these tales, and he was this guy that was a swashbuckler and did his own stunts and everything. And I think that a lot of people probably either thought he was full of shit and he wasn't, or by him being as awesome as he was, kind of revealed that they were all full of shit, you know? So I think he, and that's one of the things I kind of found it as a subtext while reading his book and, you know, his autobiography and watching interviews with him and stuff. And so I kind of fed that into it. And so finding those two little pieces right there, that was the humanity that kind of linked me to them. And that's what really drew me to both of them. Because originally I'm just trying to find a Luke, Leia, and Han love triangle. You know, I want my Hans, you know, somebody that's a swashbuckler and suave and cool and chick dig him. He's kind of the bad boy. So here's your Han. You're naive, you know, goofed. That's Luke. And then you're extremely competent female that's always pulling the boys out of the fire. You know, she's the one that kick, you know, into the garbage chute flyboys, you know, that woman. And that's what I wanted out of Hetty. And that's who she was, you know. She was like probably like 30 years too early for her time, you know.
Have you thought about writing more books based on with these characters in them?
Actually, John and I were just talking about it today. So we have all these like little pieces that I did not get to use in Fear and the Tramp, things that I learned about Chaplin. Different anecdotes and different conspiracies and different things with Chaplin that are extremely interesting and things I wanted to use, some really cool stuff. And, but there were just these that, you know, so it's just like, I have all this fruit. I don't know what to do with this. Do I make a pie with it? Do I make a strudel? I don't know what to do with all these like these cool little things. I don't even know if they all go together. And then it was just today. Just today, I finally found the emotional core to what the sequel would be. And that's what I need to care to make it. I mean, I can't make a sequel if it's just to make a sequel. Cash in. there's got to be an emotional reason for it. There's got to be, I've got to see the character arc with Charlie, and I found it today. And I'm really happy with it. Like, and I'm excited to tell more story, you know?
Oh, wow. So, how are we going to find out when that is ready to be announced?
I have no idea because I just thought of it today.
Okay.
So I can give you, I'll give you this. You get this, Wayne. You're getting one like little, nobody knows this, but we're going to go to the other theater of war. So it's tentatively entitled The Emperor and the Tramp. So we're going to go for
Akito. Okay.
So Chaplin in Japan, which he did visit Japan, and there's some great anecdotes, some really great anecdotes that I can't wait to see how I weave them into my story. Some really crazy stuff with him and Hirohito. That's why I got to use it. Like, he literally did hang out with Hirohito.
Wow. Wow. So one way we make sure you get to see this is to buy this book. Oh, by yes, the Fuhrer and the Tramp. Because if it's a big success, then you're much more likely to be able to do the second edition. That'd be great.
Yeah. And the emotional core, the thing that I found was, and I came to it naturally by trying to figure out what his emotional journey is. Mm-hmm. And the only way that I could do it is I have to do a Godfather 2, you know, I have to do past, present, and future, you know, I have to show his, you know, and that's kind of like what one of my preoccupations is, how we are built on the foundations of the past and how certain things that happened to Charlie throughout his life, actual real events, and then some made up, how those like crafted and made him the person that he is. We talked about some of them with him being a street urchin. That's definitely going to be in there, you know?
Mm. Sounds great. Oh man, I'd love to see that. I'd love to see some more of that, because there are some great people and they're fun to learn about. And I just think that these guys, you've got a great cast, that it'd be a shame to waste them and not have to do any more with them. So yeah, I think that's great.
I mean, they are actual real people, but somewhere along probably about issue 3, maybe midway through issue 3, they became my own inventions. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And by the time you got to issue 4, it's like they were writing themselves. That was some of the most joyful writing I've ever had. It's like, I'm not writing this. Like, I know what this guy would say in this set of circumstances. This is what he would say. This is how he'd behave.
That's super cool. That'd be fun.
It is. I never have been able to do that as a writer before. I mean, it's super awesome whenever to have that kind of breakthrough. I mean, I don't know. It's like they kind of have a life of their own, you know?
Wow.
So yeah, I don't want to leave them, but I gotta have an emotional reason to come back to them. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to make a Ghostbusters 2, you know?
No.
I want to make a Godfather 2.
right. Well, that'd be excellent. Well, it sounds like you've got it. Sounds like this is the beginning of the second journey, which would be great fun. It just sounds like excellent stuff. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
I want to see it happen. I really do. So, well, are there other projects you're working on, or is these guys keeping you busy?
Actually, I'm working on two other comics right now. I'm working on another one with Dexter Wee. And we've been posting some images from it. We're like about 120 or so pages into it.
Wow.
So we've got quite a bit of it done. So like, what is that? Like 5-6 issues. We're about 5 or 6 issues into it. It's about werewolves.
Oh, okay. So very different.
Yeah. Very, very different. But, it takes place in the present, but also there's a historical aspect to it too. So, you know, my basic thing, without revealing anything, is I want to do for werewolves what Bram Stoker did for vampires.
Okay.
That's the plan. And so, you know, he took like a historical figure and laid a layer of this mythical, you know, folklore on top of him and crafted and created Dracula out of, you know, Vlad the Impaler. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to do the same thing for werewolves. I want to create that mascot werewolf, the one that represents all werewolves, which we don't have, which, you know, that was one thing I realized, like, you know, if you say the Wolfman, what does that mean? You know, is Lon Chaney, you know, but that's just an actor. You're not really into what Talbot, was that his name? Yeah. Like, or is it, you know, American Werewolf in London? Is he the mascot? No, he's no, that's not Dracula stature mascot for that genre. You know, that's what I want to create. So,
wow.
And then the other one I'm working on is a, it's a World War One historical horror story about called The Angel of Mons, and it's about like I don't know if you're familiar with the myth about the Angel of Mons.
Mm-mm.
Okay, so it's like in World War One in the British trenches that the soldiers claimed to see an angel of death swoop down and destroy the German army.
Hmm.
And so I'm treating it as like a kind of a Lovecraftian horror story in, you know, World War One. And Sean Koss is drawing that. He's a fantastic illustrator. He's never done comics before, so it's kind of fun trying to find something that, you know, trying to find that style and that panel layout and stuff that works for him. But he's done like a lot of like heavy metal album covers and stuff like that. He's more of a straight up illustrator. So
cool. Wow. So if we can follow you on social media, how do we do that?
Mainly Facebook. And I do Facebook and Instagram. So I'm under – you can look up Adolf and Charlie because Facebook flags the term Führer.
But okay.
Führer and the Tramp on Instagram. And I don't know. They own each other, so I don't know what that's all about. But you, if you look up Führer and the Tramp, it does go to that page. I just can't – you know, it's not a / Führer and the Tramp. Or look me up on Facebook. But typically it's Führer and the Tramp is where I, and you could start seeing some of the werewolf stuff with Wolves of Babylon.
Wow.
On Facebook also.
Oh, cool.
And a lot of it's on Dexter's Dexter Wee. He's the artist on both of those. He posts a lot of it on his Instagram page.
Ooh, cool. So, very cool. How do you spell Wee? Dexter
Wee.
W-E-E. Okay. So we want to make sure people can do that. Because that'll be great. Well, wow. There's so much good stuff to look forward to. Be sure to get the Führer and the Tramp, though, the collected edition, $19.99 from Source Point Press. Get the order in right now so that your store can have it when it comes out, probably in about 2 months. Usually how these things work. But, Sean, you're doing wonderful stuff. Very exciting to hear all the good things you're doing. And
you,
great fun to read. I really enjoyed the Führer and the Tramp. I can't, well, I'm going to have to get that and make sure. I'll make sure my store gets it for me so I have it.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Thanks, Wayne. Yeah, and maybe encourage a couple other people.
Oh, yeah.
Read it.
I might get a couple to give to people. It might be a good thing to
do. That's awesome. Yeah, I made it. Well, the first audience of mine was myself, but I really made it for people who love comics, you know, classic movies and comics. So, yeah, I had comic book store owners in mind when I made it.
Well, it's great stuff. I can't wait to get it. It's going to be so much fun to read and to have, because I like longer stories like that. Every once in a while, I get a little free time. I dive into it and I relive it. So that's going to be one of my favorites.
Oh, awesome.
It's
really
great stuff. It's good stuff.
Well, thank you so much, Wayne.
Well, keep it up, and we'll talk about this again in the future when there's other good stuff coming down the pike.
Yeah,
we'll
have to make sure we're talking
about that. So it'll be good. So just keep doing the good stuff you're doing, because, boy, it sounds great.
Thank you. Thanks, Wayne.
That's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.